Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail bro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prison. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black power, brothers and sisters. Thank you for tuning in to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense Nightly Broadcast. Tonight, we are going to play several clips in regards to tonight's topic, Pan-Africanism or Perish. Our regular scheduled host, Brother Eugene Talford, will be back with us on next Thursday. So in the meantime, in between time, we're going to play clips from several of our great minds within the African diaspora, to include Kwame Ture, Ambassador Arakana, Dr. John Henry Clark, and if time permits, we'll hear from Asa Hilliard. But we'll start this broadcast off with a clip from the father of black power, Brother Kwame Ture, speaking on Pan-Africanism. We'll hear a clip from Ambassador Arakana, entitled A Message to the African Diaspora. And then, if time permits, we'll hear from the great elder, Dr. John Henry Clark, as well as Dr. Asa Hilliard. So sit back, take notes. Class is in session. Black power.
Pan-Africanism, what I'd like to do in the 20-minute period we have is to give you its general outline, its general development, and of course its future path. Some people think that Pan-Africanism is a response to colonialism. While certainly Pan-Africanism responded to colonialism, we must not think that it's colonialism that brought Pan-Africanism into being. Of course, to see this clearly, we should just look at the general evolutionary processes of all societies on a universal basis. All societies have a tendency to go from a smaller social aggregate to a larger social aggregate, from the family to the tribe to the clan to the nation to the continent. This is an evolutionary process. This theory can be seen in living practice if today we were to look at Europe. Europe everywhere speaks of European continental unity. Even though Europe has fought more fratricidal wars than any other continent or all the continents put together, Europe still speaks of European continental unity. Of course, Africa will unify before Europe, but that's not the point of discussion here this evening. The fact that Europe, with all the fratricidal wars she has fought, can speak of continental unity shows this evolutionary process. Africa, like any other society anywhere in the world, was involved in this same evolutionary process, going from family to tribe to clan to nation to continent. This evolutionary process was interrupted by European imperialism. It came in two forms, slavery and colonialism. First, they took over 300 million, the strongest, out of Africa, and then they divided Africa at the Berlin Conference. So you can see that Africa herself was moving on this evolutionary process. This evolutionary process, which would lead to continental unity, and Africa will still be the first continent unified, was interrupted by European capitalism. Since it was interrupted by European capitalism and evolutionary process, the only way that Africa can unite today is through a revolutionary process aiming at a socialist economy. If capitalism destroyed us, it doesn't make sense to use capitalism to continue with it. We must use the antithesis of capitalism, which of course is socialism. And certainly if the evolutionary process has been interrupted, the only way we can capture the time lost is through a revolutionary process. We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people. So this, then, is the general outlines of Pan-Africanism. So you must not think that Africanism just began. Had Africa been left untrampled by European imperialism, we would have a long time achieved continental unity. Secondly, Pan-Africanism must be seen as a movement, a mass movement. And this mass movement must be properly understood. Africa, of course, because of racism, is belittled everywhere. And many people do not see Africa's constant, underline the word constant, contributions to world civilization. Since the 1940s, Africa has given, even before the 1940s, actually, we can go back to the Honorable Marcus Garvey, Africa has given to world political movements a mass character. Africans revolt in masses, never as a vanguard party. If you look at the independence struggle in Africa, it was nothing less than mass. If you look at the struggle in the Caribbean for independence, it was nothing less than mass. And even in the United States of America, the only movement they call a mass movement is our movement. Therefore, this mass character must be properly understood. Pan-Africanism has this mass character. Africans have this mass character in responding. And our responsibility is to bring this mass character together, make it precise, so that it can direct its blows at the enemy, hitting him until we knock him down. Therefore, the task of Pan-Africanism is to gather the masses of our people together in the same organization, irrespective of where they find themselves, be it in Europe, be it in the United States, be it in the Caribbean, or be it in Africa. This is the first aspect, then, we must understand. Pan-Africanism found its organizational expression in 1900. Here, a Pan-African conference, here the word conference, was organized by Africans from all over the world. They came together deciding that something must be done for Africa. One of the leading organizers of this conference was a man by the name of Henry Sylvester Williams, born in Trinidad, a man whom you should do some history on, a very, very great man. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois attended the conference, but he was not one of the leaders in 1900. By 1917, 1918, the idea of a necessity for a Pan-African Congress, not conference, Congress, was to be called. But most of the people who did the conference were dead. Henry Sylvester Williams was dead. A lot of them were dead. Du Bois was about the only one who was alive. Du Bois recognized he had a historic responsibility to continue the work of Pan-Africanism, so he called the first Pan-African Congress. Make a clear distinction. The first one in 1900 was a conference. Du Bois, being intelligent, understanding that a conference is limited and a Congress has more elasticity and can go longer, called it a Pan-African Congress. From the 1990s up until 1945, we could say seriously, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois just about single-handedly kept the flame of Pan-Africanism alive. One thing must also be underlined to you. Pan-Africanism was brought into being in its organized form by the Africans outside of Africa. This was done only because of the oppression of Africa. At that time, Africa was under total colonial domination. There could be no political meetings. As a matter of fact, if you had the paper of the Honorable Marcus Garvey, you could go to jail. So the conditions were such that it was difficult for the Africans on the continent to organize. Africans off of the continent, recognizing this, came quickly to fill up that gap. So Pan-Africanism itself was brought to bear by the diaspora. But you must not think that the diaspora brought Pan-Africanism for the diaspora. Not at all. The center of the discussions has always been Africa. This must be properly understood. Some people try to shift it, make it take it somewhere else, but Africa has always been the focus. Du Bois carried on his congresses up until the Fifth Congress in 1945. Because of time, we're just going through them quickly. In 1945, saw the Fifth Pan-African Congress. Here, you had Africans born on the continent, in the Caribbean, and Africans, of course, born in Europe and the United States. At this Fifth Pan-African Congress, there were three co-secretaries, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, George Padmore of Trinidad, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. So he had an African from the Caribbean, one from the United States, and one from the continent, who were co-secretaries of the Fifth Pan-African Congress. The Fifth Pan-African Congress is crucial for us. A decision was made there. They said that the final confrontation with colonialism is coming. After all, this is 1945, and you must know that there's negative and positives in everything. I remember once as a young man reading Mein Kampf on an airplane, sitting next to a woman. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean what I'm doing? I'm reading Mein Kampf." "Why are you reading it?" I said, "Well, Hitler's a very important man. He had historical effects on the world, you know." She said, "Well, I'm a Jew." I said, "Have you read it?" She said, "No." I said, "Oh, that's bad." I said, "Have you not read Sun Yat-sen?" She said, "No." I said, "He says the first law of war is to know the enemy. If I were a Jew, I would read everything there is to read on Hitler." Of course. Of course. So while reading Hitler, she was arguing. I said, "Well, Hitler had some positive effect anyway." She said, "What positive effect did Hitler have?" I said, "Hitler weakened European imperialism. He weakened the British, he weakened the French, he weakened the Portuguese, he weakened the Belgians, and that's how we got independence." These are facts of life. When Hitler got through with Britain, when the Indians said they want independence, Britain could do anything but get out of the way and let them have independence. Matter of fact, they got Mahatma Gandhi quick because they didn't want to deal with the armed struggle that the Indians were preparing for British imperialism in India. And by the time India was free, well, it was over. China came up after China, of course, Africa throughout, etc., etc. And by 1960, in 15 short years of the declaration of the Fifth Pan-African Congress in 1945, two-thirds of the African continent was independent. You must understand clearly the importance of this. Now, at the Fifth Pan-African Congress, they said the only solution to the final confrontation is mass organization. And I say, if you look at Africans, we have nothing but mass character in our struggle. Of course, this mass character for the moment is spontaneous and must be transformed to something that is planned and permanent. But certainly the mass character is there. If you just look back to the Rodney King situation, those Africans who rebelled, rebelled en masse. They had no planning. That's how backward they were. They didn't think about it. Just on the spot, they said, "Okay, it's too much. Let's go. Let's get them." And everybody said, "Okay, let's get them." And we rise up as mass and we get them. And then we sit down for 29 years. Of course. Of course. But the mass character is there. And we must understand this mass character. The Fifth Pan-African Congress, most of Africa, of course, was colonized. Kwame Nkrumah came to change all this. By 1958, he threw the British out of Cape Coast and named it Ghana. Nkrumah declared before the entire world that the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it's linked with the entire continent of Africa and its unification and liberty. And Ghana, Nkrumah made Ghana the base for every movement that fought against colonialism.
Without further ado, I'd like to welcome a person that I have felt deeply fortunate to know, and I've actually told her this. When I first saw her speak, I said, I've been waiting for you since Sékou Touré passed away. And she has not only stepped into those giants of Kwame Nkrumah, Sékou Touré, and others of the independence movement, she has actually filled them so much so that we have to bring new shoes for the kind of presence that that she has. I'd like to welcome Her Excellency Ambassador Chihombori Kau. As a Francophone, I have to be very careful how to pronounce that. Ambassador.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to your home. The Great Africa House, right here in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. To the presidents who are sitting at the podium, I want to take a moment to thank you for taking your time in your busy schedules to come and join us on this momentum occasion. To my sisters, Chairman or President of NAPIO, thank you again. This was last minute, but you had the call and you answered and you jumped up and you are here today. To my sister, Ms. Jensen, to my brother, Kojo Yanka, some of you, I have to give a shout out. He's writing a book titled From Gemstown to Gemstown. I can't wait. It's going to be a thriller. To all my other diaspora sisters, members of PADIA, members of PADWA, we truly are grateful for you taking the time to come here today. Roland Martin, back there, this is my first time to see you in person. A lot of people don't look the same on television as they are in person. I have to say, you look exactly like what I had expected you to look like. Thank you for taking the time to come here. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed an honor to stand in front of you this afternoon to celebrate this momentous occasion. And of course, I always forget my husband, Saab Kau. He's sitting somewhere back there. Saab, raise your hand. Everybody's looking. A friend of mine reminded me, because I always call him, he's an old shoe that is very comfortable to wear. And so a friend of mine called this morning and said, so how is the old comfortable shoe? And I said, still very comfortable. Thank you all again. And my sister Remy, Chairman of PADWA, thank you again for also always being there, ready to step up and do your part as we come together to uplift our motherland. I took office 2.5 years ago as a dumb, ignorant family physician coming from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I had no idea what I was going to be doing in Washington. As a matter of fact, I actually felt kind of funny and silly thinking me, a medical doctor, can be a diplomat. But be it as it may, singularly the one thing, I came here, by the way, with no plans of staying. I was coming here top 6 months after 6 months. Look at my husband, honey, I tried. It didn't work out. Look at the chairman of the African Union who had appointed me. Thank you, Madam Zuma. It was great, but I could not do it. But 6 months into this position, one issue that kept coming to me and became very apparent was the disrespect for the African. I knew it existed, I just didn't understand the depth and the profoundness of it. And not only that, as I began to understand it even deeper, I began to also understand its economic implications when it comes to how we are perceived on the world stage, how this simple fact of simply disrespecting the African had serious implications and is at the root cause of why Africa is not able to move forward. And as I went and tried to understand and dig further to say, what is it about us as black people around the globe, why is it that we are so disrespected no matter where you go? And I often say, was there a memo sent out to say wherever you go, if you are not a black person, you see a black person, you're automatically superior to them, and you have a right to disrespect them? This memo did not miss anybody. It went to non-black people, but here's the real shocker. It also went to us black people to say, accept that you are inferior. You automatically take an inferior position. And I'm going to have to tell you something that has become a realization that I just, and this is where I am stuck as I try to understand, how did this message just go through and percolated so through? Now we are on automatic pilot. It's almost as if we've undergone a genetic mutation. We don't even have to be told. We pass it on to our children. Have you ever wondered, of all the colors on earth, why were two colors chosen? Black color and white color. Follow me on this one. You take a white color, you associate it with Jesus Christ. You associate it with the angels. You associate it with purity and everything wonderful and everything desirable. And then you take a race that's not even white and you say you are white. Yeah. And then you take another color. You associate it with the devil. You associate it with everything undesirable. I've never seen a bank robber wearing a white mask. All the villains on movies are black. Everything undesirable is black. And then you take another race that are not even black and say, you guys, you are black. Yeah. Now go at it. As we black mothers are trying to raise our children in our own homes, as much as we try to tell them that you're black and you're beautiful, guess what? The minute they step outside the door, the messages are completely different. A barrage of subliminal messages telling our children that that which you represent is horrible. How do we fight against that? How do I tell my granddaughter that you're black and beautiful, but the world tells her otherwise? The voices echoing her blackness as a symbol of everything undesirable are much, much louder than even we black mothers. We come together, we can never drown those subliminal messages. They were all by design. Let me take you to the beginning. Certainly for Africa, your Africa, your continent. Because as we gather here today, as we try to strategize, as we try to create those linkages between those Africans away from the continent and the Africans on the continent, we must understand, how did we get here? And for Africa, it starts with that monumental decision when they, the colonizers, came together in Berlin in 1884. And let me say, prior to 1884, they were coming to Africa in a haphazard way. They had started with slavery. And then when they felt like they needed the slaves to stay on the continent, they say, oh, we no longer believe in slave trade. Let's stop it. No. It was really just another way of saying the labor is needed on the continent. Let's keep the monkeys on the continent so we can continue to exploit them. So 1884, they met in Berlin to organize themselves so they can effectively loot from the monkeys. They did not meet in Berlin to see to it that Africa would prosper. No. Let me repeat. The colonizers met in order to see to it that your Africa, our Africa, and her children, not only on the continent, are forever defeated and dominated. That was 135 years ago. The manner in which they did it, they took out the map of Africa while the Africans were sleeping, minding their own business. Started to chop up your continent into the tiny little countries that we see today. The bigger and more powerful a kingdom was, the more countries that came out of it. Not only more countries, but these countries were given to different colonizers who spoke different languages. Let me bring it home for a second. Pretend you're driving from Zambia. Mm-hmm. You're speaking English. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon you're in Angola. You're speaking Portuguese. Then DRC, French. Equatorial Guinea, Spanish. Southern Cameroon, French. Southern Cameroon, English. Northern Cameroon, French. You are now in Nigeria, English. Hello. These were the same people. Prior to 1884, we were powerful, amazing kingdoms with well-established educational and religious systems. If the truth be told, we had the civilization. We were the civilized. They were the devils, the uncivilized ones. They set out to take everything that symbolized civilization in Africa. To this day, they're still refusing to give up those relics. If those relics were not that good, why are you keeping them? We were way ahead of them in our civilization. They set out to destroy us. And Berlin Conference put the nail on that coffin. So they gave Djibouti the same sovereignty as the United States. They gave Burundi the same sovereignty as China. They gave Togo. You see, the EU realizes individual little countries, they can't survive on the world stage. So they come together as the European Union. Now picture this now. So they cut up this Africa into the tiny little countries, small economies that could never survive on their own, but gave them the same sovereignty as the big boys. So that way, when the little bitty countries go to the world stage for the purposes of development and discussing trade, they're wannabe boxers who are being thrown into the heavyweight boxing ring every day. How do you put China in the same boxing ring with Eswatini? Eswatini has 1.2 million people. China has 1.4 billion people. And you put them on the same stage and say, go at it, negotiate. Are you with me? This is insanity of the highest order. How have we allowed this carnage to go on? When Eswatini is thrown in the same boxing ring with China and Eswatini collapses before Eswatini even gets on the stage, the world says, well, Eswatini, what's wrong with you? Why can't you take care of your people? Well, China came in and said, Eswatini, give me all your gold or else. And if Eswatini does not agree, they just go on next door to Lesotho and give Lesotho an extra dollar. And if Lesotho doesn't take it, they just jump on to Togo, Central African Republic. It was all by design. 1884. They did something else in addition to chopping us up. They also set out to make the African believe that everything African was bad and undesirable, and everything Western, particularly French and British, was more desirable. We call that the legacy of colonization. Prior to that, they had started long working on the slaves. Make them think everything about them, forget anything about Africa. Where you come from is a horrible place with diseased and dying people, constantly at war with themselves, uncivilized. Cut out any communications with them. You need to just know what we tell you. And we call that the legacy of slavery. So that way, you look at where we are today. 135 years later, a system that was put in place to see to it that Africa and her children are forever defeated, that Africa is forever exploited, remains in place today, alive and well. And we sit here and we ask ourselves, why isn't Africa moving forward? Why does Africa continue to be taken advantage of? Well, I'll tell you why, very simply. Until Africa comes together as a continent speaking with one voice, one continent, one people, nothing, and I repeat, nothing is going to change. As individual little African countries, we are wannabe boxers. We will never make it fighting against the heavyweights. We must speak with one voice.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what our Pan-African leaders wanted to see happen in 1963 when they came together in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. They clearly stated that Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, and that African Union was now. They said Africa must speak with one voice. It is the only way for Africa to take its rightful place on the world stage. Sadly, when they went to Addis Ababa in 1963, they were divided. We had two factions, the Casablanca group and the Monrovia group. The Casablanca group were saying Africa for the Africans at home and abroad, and African Union now. This was Ghana, Guinea, Mali, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Only seven. The other 25 of the 32 who attended were the Monrovia group. They were the nationalists. They said, let's go slow. Let's kind of wait on this Pan-African thing. 55 years later, 56 this year, we're still going slow. As if it wasn't bad enough that we were divided up into the tiny little countries that we are today. The gift that Berlin Conference gave us. One other thing that France did between 1958 and 1961, in the name of giving us our independence as African countries, France forced the Francophone, and I hate that terminology. There is no such thing as Francophone, Anglophone. They made it up. But for the purposes of communication, I will use that. 14 of those countries, they said, in order for you to get your independence from us, you must sign this document. You thought they could have found a better name for the document. The document was called the Pact for the Continuation. I repeat, the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization. We are talking about giving you independence, but sign this pact for the continuation of colonization in a different format. And I'm going to highlight some of those issues that they said you must agree to if you are going to be independent. Hello. Maybe we need to redefine the meaning of independence for the French. France said, you see, you monkeys, you don't know how to manage your money. We're going to demand that you deposit 85% of your bank reserves with the French Minister of Finance. Under the French Central Bank, under the control of the French Minister of Finance. France is then going to take your 85% bank deposits from each and every one of you. Deposit those funds in the French stock market under the French name. And you may or may not know the returns. Today, as we speak, the latest figures are saying for every 14 billion that France invests in the stock market from Africa, they are realizing upwards of 300 billion in return. Every year, year in, year out, because of these deposits from the African countries, France is taking out of Africa over $500 billion. Now figure it out. For every 14 billion, the returns on the investment are over 300 billion, and they are taking over 500 billion. So in actuality, France is taking out of Africa trillions of dollars year in and year out from us poor people, Africans. Back to the pact. So should you want to access some of your money that you have deposited with France, you have to submit your country's financial returns. And if approved, you get to get it as a loan. You can only access up to 20% of your money year in, year out, as a loan at commercial interest rates. Your own money. As if that was not enough. They said all your minerals discovered, yet to be discovered, all your oil discovered, yet to be discovered, France and French companies have the first right of refusal. If there's anything left over that the French companies do not want, your people might have. To this day. They said you will only use the currency that we created for you because you are special Africans. We call it the CFA. There was the Central African CFA and the Western African CFA, same animal. And that France is the only one that can print it for you. 1958. Fast forward. They're still printing it for us. And if you start misbehaving, they just stop printing your money. And your country's in trouble. They also said your language of instruction shall be French, whether you like it or not. That France will have military presence in your country. That your military can only be trained by France. That you can only buy military equipment from France. That you cannot have any military alliance with your neighbor. And that in the event of war, your allegiance is only to France. And furthermore, because they have military presence in your country, they can invade you without notice should they feel that the interests of France in your country are being violated. Fast forward, 2019, nothing has changed. The same people who have the audacity to tell us that we are poor countries, they are taking trillions out of Africa every year. And what is the African doing? Like an obedient, programmed black man, we just give in. We know the facts, but we just do nothing about it. Now, you have to say some of the fears are real, because if France that has sold you inferior equipment to theirs, France that has trained your military to be inferior to their military, they are now in your country. They can invade you. They have the permission to do so. They can destabilize you. And then one might say, why is it that African leaders haven't done anything about this deplorable situation? Well, let me tell you, my brother and sister, they have tried. Documented to this day, 22 coups where leaders were assassinated. France had something to do with it. The first seven, when they decided they were pulling out of the CFA and that they're going to print their own money, they were assassinated. Every time an African leader has tried to do what's best for their country, they were assassinated. Majority of them aided by France. It's a known fact. And then others, they were just mercenaries who felt that when there was a natural resource discovered in one country, they wanted to create a coup. So while the country is thrown into a civil war, they're siphoning the natural resource. We know of one particular story that had we not known about it, it would have been, oh, there we go again, the Africans. In about 25 years ago, a group of young, rich, white kids were having fun in Cape Town. They found out that there was oil in Equatorial Guinea that just been discovered, and they wanted it. So they set out a plan to have a coup in Equatorial Guinea. So while the Guineans are busy fighting a civil war, they will be siphoning the oil. But they made one mistake. There were two planes. One was to leave South Africa, stop in Zimbabwe, pick up more ammunition on their way to hunt in Equatorial Guinea. Another plane was taking off in the Caribbean that had this puppet diaspora who was supposed to be the next president. Mugabe wondered why such young people needed such powerful ammunition to go hunt in Equatorial Guinea. In doing his research further, he found out that this was a coup in the making. He allowed them to land in Zimbabwe. They loaded their plane, and just before takeoff, they were all arrested. The ringleader of that group was none other than the son of the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher. She had to fly to Zimbabwe and paid handsomely to get her son out. The last one of those prisoners left Zimbabwe about 6-7 years ago. Had these young people succeeded, it would have been another coup. There you go, the Africans again. Such, my brothers and sisters, is the story of your Africa. They don't do coups anymore. They simply create instability. So when you hear of an instability in an African country, ask yourself, what is really going on? Because what they are telling you is really going on is just a shiny object. The real issue is over here. And you need to stop before you start being used as an instrument of your own self-destruction. They want to throw to you, oh, African leaders are corrupt. I just love that buzzword. Remember what I said, we need to define some of these words for them. Do you really want to know what corruption is? I like to think as black women, and we're going to talk about us black women here. We're smart people. There are two things. One is carrying a briefcase with $50 billion, which is what they say, oh, gets out of Africa every year for corruption. And by the way, they only tell you the $50 billion gets out of Africa. They don't tell you where it's going. You see, corruption is a team sport. We want all players. We want all players to come to the table. Okay, fine, we give it to you. $50 billion is going out of Africa. And then there's another thief over here with a briefcase with 500 billion sisters. Which one should we go after first? Wow. They want us to spend time. I am not saying we should not talk about corruption out of Africa. Don't get me wrong. Yes, we must talk about the thief carrying the $50 billion, but we must also not forget the thief that is carrying 500 billion. And by the time that thief is done investing that 500 billion, we're looking at trillions out of Africa. Now, do you see how quickly the 50 billion becomes the larger crumb under the table? And they're busy pointing at you. Oh, you see your brother, he got the bigger crumb under the table. I'm like, hell no. I want to be on the table. Don't get me stuck in the mud under the table when the real issues are on the table. We are not even on the table, my brothers and sisters, to tackle the issues that truly matter for our Africa. We must realize that. Let's refuse to fight over which brother got the bigger chunk under the table.
That's right.
We want to get on the table.
That's right.
And the only way for us to get on the table is to understand our circumstances, is to understand how we got here, to see our Africa with 2020 vision. So we, the beautiful, intelligent, sophisticated, highly adaptable, and totally indestructible Africans can do what we need to do to move our Africa from the doldrums where we were left by the Berlin Conference, from the losing lane that we were left in by the Berlin Conference, into the right lane, where we can truly look at our issues and address them as Africans for Africa. So all is not lost, my brothers and sisters. The wishes of our Pan-African fathers from 1963, March last year, the African leaders got together and signed a decision that is now putting us on the path to finish the unfinished business of the Berlin Conference. They signed what we are now calling the African Continental Free Trade Area, where Africa is now going to negotiate as a block, as one continent, one Africa, one heart, one soul, one mind.
Yes, sir.
African heads of state signed that agreement. We only needed 22 to ratify. Exactly 13 months later, This is something that the colonizers were laughing at us. You Africans, you'll never put this through. This CFTA thing, you'll never get the ratifications. Years down the line, it's never going to happen. It's going to be a piece of paper in a drawer somewhere. Because the reality is, ratifications, my brothers and sisters, do take a long time. They take years. But guess what? 13 months. April this year, the 22nd ratification was deposited to the African Union. We're now sitting on 23 and more are coming. Because you know what? The sleeping giant is rising. The sleeping giant has found her teeth and used recognize, let me underscore, the sleeping giant has found her teeth. Her teeth. Game is over. When I speak to businesses in this country, my mandate is to see to it that Africa and the United States are the best partners the world has ever seen. America, the United States, and the Americas is the only region that has a heritage connection to Africa. And it is for that reason in particular that I'm on a mission to see to it that the marriage between Africa and the United States is the best marriage the world has ever seen. It is a marriage that's going to give birth not only to many children, but many beautiful children. I'm a woman on a mission. And that's why it is important that we begin to understand each other. That the misconceptions, the misunderstandings, the Africans don't understand the Americans, and the Americans don't understand the Africans. Our Caucasian brothers and sisters come to the negotiating table on a high horse. To them I say, get off your high horse. And we come to the negotiating table feeling automatically inferior. I also say to all of us, you are just as good as anybody else. Get off that underground. You need to rise up somewhere in the middle. We must rise up, they must come down. And somewhere in the middle is where we are going to have the truly desired, meaningful conversations that are going to take us where we need to be. And this is why we are here today.
Thank you.
My son Kwame, I thank you for all the wonderful creating that bridge that's going to get us to the table with a clear mind, clear vision, understanding that when we understand each other, it is then and only then can the children of Africa take their beloved continent to its rightful place on the world stage. The place that we have vacated for far too long, but we are now saying enough is enough. We, the children of Africa, as a united friend, we are going to come join our hands and sing the best melody the world has ever heard as we waltz our way to our motherland, not as 55 African countries, not as 1.27 billion brothers and sisters on the continent, not as over 400 million African diaspora around the globe, but children of one mother Africa. Let's give the world the best melody the world has ever heard. You see, birds sing not because they can. They sing because they have a song. As children of one mother Africa, we do have a song. Let's join hands. Let's give that world that beautiful song as we waltz our way across the Atlantic back to the motherland. I thank you.
My name is Sam Hart, and I'm the Director General of the Abia State Marketing and Quality Management Agency. At the onset of the global COVID-19 pandemic, the Governor of Abia State, Dr. Okezie Victor Ekwazu, gave a charge to Abia tailors and artisans to rise up and meet the global shortage in face masks and other PPEs. I am proud to announce to you that Abia tailors and artisans have been able to produce over 1 million face masks, which has been distributed around Nigeria. ABA has the capacity, to bridge the global shortage in PPE, nose masks, and other medical essentials, and we are here for you. You can reach us on phone number 0817-777-1306.
Hello everyone, welcome to today's episode of The Osasa Show. In today's program, we have the former African Union representative to the United States, Ambassador Arikana Chihombori-Kwau. She will be speaking to us about how Africa can reposition itself post-COVID-19. Don't go anywhere, it promises to be a very enlightening interview. Back to the Osasa Show. Joining me now is Her Excellency Ambassador Arikana Chihombori-Kwau. Welcome to today's program, Your Excellency.
Thank you for having me, my dear.
You're most welcome. First of all, I must commend you and thank you for the relentless effort you have put in speaking for Africans world over. You popularly spoke about the French continuous colonization of African countries, particularly in West and Central Africa. This led to the stopping of the CFA franc being used in most of these countries. In December of 2019, these eight countries adopted the ECO currency. However, critics have still claimed that France still has its tutelage on these African countries because the ECO is still backed by the euro. And France is also making sure that they are also the people standing in for the currency. What do you have to say about that?
Well, what I can say is thank you for having me, my dear Kuta. I appreciate all the work that you're doing to continue the conversation. Really, we're at a critical time in the history of Africa, and it is your world. You, the youth of Africa, this is your world. Our job as your elders, we know we have messed up this Africa for you, but we would like to fix it and make it right. If we can't finish the job, at least when we leave this earth, we want to be able to say to you children, this is what we have done. There was a problem in our village, and this is where you need to pick up. Going to the issue of the ECO with France, what is needed is complete separation. What President Macron is suggesting to have an ECO that is going to be pegged to the euro is totally unacceptable. To have an ECO that when leaders of the African countries want to trade, all the trades have got to go through the French central bank and then pass on whichever country is wishing to trade with those former French colonies. That is also unacceptable. What is needed is complete separation. African leaders are quite capable of handling their own affairs. African countries, especially ECOWAS, they're quite capable of handling their own currency. They're already having discussions. The heads of state are having their own discussions. They have set up their own parameters as to what it's going to take for them to be ready to have their own single West African currency. France just needs to stop interfering. This is a program for the African heads of state in West Africa. So for France to run in and think they can just steal the program away from the African heads of state, it's not going to happen. Ghana has already let them know. Nigeria has already let them know. So this is not going to happen. They can try to play games again, but we need to let President Macron know that we're not stupid. We know exactly what game he's playing. It's not going to work. The youth of Africa, the children of Africa, we may have been asleep for far too long, but President Macron needs to know once and for all that the children of Africa are waking up. Enough is enough. The games that they have played with us over the centuries, those games are over. They need to realize that this is a new game. They need to strategize because the Africans are not going to take it anymore. So those games of trying to put in this puppet euro renamed Echo is not going to work.
Ambassador, should we at least pat ourselves on the back? The fact that you clearly advocated that the representative of France sitting on the board of the West African Central Bank should be removed, and it was that representative was removed. Should we at least pat ourselves on the back for the fact that you also advocated that their currency, this CFA, should be changed, and it was changed? Should we pat ourselves on the back for this achievement, or is there still so much more that we need to fight for?
No, we are not ready to pat ourselves on the back yet. A lot more work is yet to be done. You got to understand that France is going to be a tough nut to crack. Uprooting France out of Africa, period, is going to be a tall order. Let's make no mistake about that. For France, getting out of Africa is a do or die. For them, without Africa, France is a worse than a third world country. So we know that. What is needed from France is to treat Africa fairly. Come to the table and treat the Africans fairly. Africa is a huge continent. Africa could feed all of China, all of India, all of Europe. We could even house the citizens of those countries. That's how humongous and that's how rich the African continent is. We are simply asking that those who engage Africa from outside Africa come to Africa with your suitcases chock full of humility, honor, and respect for the Africans. We will roll out the red carpet for you. But continued exploitation of the continent is no longer going to be tolerated. And for those who have gotten away with it for centuries, we want to send a message that is loud and clear that enough is enough. The game is over. Come to Africa and treat the Africans fairly. All we are asking is that they treat Africa and her children fairly, with respect, and do what is right and do what is just. Do what you would want done for your own children in Europe, or wherever you are coming from. The little girls and the little boys in France, whatever their needs are also the needs of the little girls and little boys in Africa. We are not going to sit around anymore and watch our children starving to death. We are not going to sit around anymore and watch our women die while giving birth to another life. That time is over now. We can no longer play politics. We can no longer play diplomacy. How do we have a diplomatic conversation with a master who has never left? We are under the table while the master is sitting on the table in our house, eating our food that we would have served him. And then from under the table, the master is dictating that we should have a diplomatic conversation while he is on the table and we are under the table. That is not a conversation that can be diplomatic. In fact, we should be beating up France. We should have been beating up France a long time ago. And yet we're still under the table and begging for them to drop a few crumbs. And while we are under the table, they're telling us how we should organize ourselves in order to divide the few crumbs. No, France needs to know once and for all that what needs to happen is that France needs to come to the table as an equal partner. We are more than happy to negotiate with France as an equal partner. And France must understand Africa is big enough. There's enough for all of us. There's no need for the French companies to be so greedy. There's no need for France to be so greedy. Africa is big enough, and our hearts as Africans are big enough that we're ready to welcome the world. But they must come to Africa with respect for the Africans, just like we go to their countries with respect for their people. We are not asking them for anything that they would not ask of us when we come to their countries.
Exactly,
we are demanding respect.
Yes.
You come to Africa, you better respect the African.
Most
and
definitely.
That is all we are asking.
Yes, permit me to interject. I think one of the most shocking data that you released during one of your conversations was the fact that 50% of the reserves in these West African countries were domiciled in France. But during this recent meeting with the heads of state and President Macron, he said that that would no longer happen, that all the money in the West African and Central African Central Bank will remain as is. Is that enough, or is there more we need to do in preserving Africa's wealth for Africans in particular?
Well, what I would like to see is the action speaks louder than words. He made that proclamation. I have not heard anything yet that is saying the heads of state are no longer required to deposit their reserves with the Central Bank of France. So if you have more information on that, please enlighten me. It's one thing to make that proclamation. It's another thing to actually actualize it. Until I see it in writing, until I know that the heads of state are no longer depositing their finances, their financial reserves with France, it's just words coming from President Macron. We must actualize his words.
We cannot overemphasize the importance of good leadership. Because women like yourself held this sensitive position of African Union's permanent representative to the U.S., you use this platform to shine light on critical issues such as this. The world, even those of us living here in Africa, on the continent, in Nigeria, did not know this was going on in our neighboring countries. But you used your position to shine light on this very sensitive issue. So you can definitely agree with me that leadership is very important. What can African leaders do at this point, given the global pandemic? The COVID-19 has affected economies, it's affected the way we interact socially. What can African leaders do now to reposition itself from a place of strength, from a place of power, to ensure that our continent thrives once and for all, and we don't just pay lip service to the fact that, yes, we're rich in natural resources, yes, we're a blessed continent, but we start to exemplify these blessings given to us?
Well, first of all, I'm constantly reminding everybody to go back to the Berlin Conference. If we understand why they met in Berlin, it's easy to understand where Africa is today. If we understand what happened in 1884, from November 1884 to February of 1885, we will understand why we are today. If we also understand what took place during those 4 months, it will also disgust us to say 136 years later, a strategy that was put in place to keep us forever defeated and dominated remains in place today. And we actually simply have completely forgotten about it. We have normalized it. We have accepted it. Berlin Conference intentionally broke us up into the tiny little economies that cannot survive on their own. Let me reiterate what I've always said. How can Togo negotiate with the European Union? How does Djibouti negotiate with China? How does Central African Republic negotiate with the United States? We must learn something from the United States. United States understood that as Delaware, the state of Delaware, cannot survive, as the state of Illinois alone cannot survive, California, even California and Texas, the biggest states in the United States, they knew their strength was in the numbers and in their unity. So they came together and created the United States of America. Africa should be a continent that needs to grow up to be like the United States. We must come together and be the Africa that we were before the Berlin Conference. Berlin Conference was a strategy designed to see to it that we will forever be chasing our tails as tiny little economies. We must come together. That is why our Pan-African Fathers met in 1963, precisely to put together, to rebuild that which was destroyed by the colonizers by breaking us up during the Berlin Conference. Sadly, they did not succeed. It took us 56 years since 1963 to finally come up with what we are now calling the African Continental Free Trade Area, which was signed in 2018 by the African heads of state. Implementation of that decision was supposed to be in July. Thanks to COVID, it's been pushed back to January. When we come together as Africa, when we go to the negotiating table, as Africa, the continent, we are a powerhouse. We are a heavyweight. And we belong on the world stage with other heavyweight boxers. But to honestly think that Togo can go to the world market as Togo, that is ridiculous, it is laughable, and it is unbelievable that for 135 years, we have allowed this stupidity to go on? How does Djibouti go to the world stage and claim sovereignty, standing next to the United States, standing next to China, standing next to the European Union, standing next to India? Djibouti is going to be swallowed. It is just that simple. And we Africans sit back and complain about why Djibouti is not doing this, why Togo is not doing this, why Malawi is not doing this. These are little boys being forced, being thrown in the heavyweight boxing ring every day. Let's understand our Africa from the root. Let's not be forced to complain about the leaves of this tree and the flowers of this tree, which are going to come and go one season after the other, and completely disregard the root causes of why Africa is where it is today. So to answer your question, what Africa needs is unity, is an Africa speaking with one voice. None of the former French colonies can fight France on their own. It's only when they come together as West Africa, when Africans come together as Central Africa, but even better, when we come together as the continent, can we take a position and push back in a manner that we can actually succeed. Now, I have to say, my young daughter, that time is around the corner, because the African youth are waking up. The Africans are saying enough is enough. We've been asleep for far too long. We are waking up from our slumber of centuries. Yes, granted, we were systematically put there. We were systematically brainwashed. But the game is up, and the Western world and now the Eastern world, they must also wake up and smell the coffee, that they can no longer continue this game with the old rules. It is a new game that is calling for new rules of engagement. We are open. We are Africans. We have a huge heart. This is who we are, and we are ready to accommodate anybody that's going to come to us with respect. That is all we are asking. We are asking that they respect us. We are asking that they treat us fairly. These unfair trade policies can no longer be tolerated. So my hope is, come January next year, we can officially implement the African Continental Free Trade Area. So our Africa, united, can go to the world stage as one customs union. Now we are talking of a superpower. Now we are talking of a powerhouse. United, nobody can mess with us. So that is the answer. That is the solution to Africa's problems. But to try and deal with these issues on a national level, it's never going to work. We are forever going to be chasing our tails, which is precisely where they want us to be. And they have succeeded. So to those who contrived the Berlin Conference, I say to you from your grave, wherever you are, congratulations. Job well done. 135 years later, the children of Africa are still chasing. We are still chasing our tails.
Ambassador Arikana, understanding the root cause to any problem is one step towards fixing it. So I thank you so much for clearly elucidating and explaining the root cause of Africa's problems. But would you also consider the lack of capable leadership as an endemic issue across Africa? We talk about the issue of corruption across African leaders. We talk about the issue of ineptitude, the issue of basic education for most of these leaders. You hear the conversations that most of these leaders have and you wonder, are they even educated enough to hold this position of power? So what is the solution, homegrown solutions that we as Africans can prepare to pick the right leaders? Because we see a lot of thugging and violence during the elections, and anybody who has the money, the financial capacity, just assumes that power of leadership without having the requisite knowledge and self-composure to actually attain that level of power. So what can we do as Africans, African youths, people passionate about this continent, to elect the right leaders? We understand that the root cause has been decided over 135 years ago, but what can we do as a people to change the course of things to ensure that we have capable men and women at the helm of affairs to lead this continent forward?
Let me give you an example, my daughter, of you and I on a journey and a few of your friends, and we're lost in the forest. And in our way, in our efforts to go home, we pick up the wrong lane. instead of going east, we are going west. It doesn't matter how much strategizing we do. We are on a losing path. We are not going home. Until we find our way and turn around and be on the right path going east, that is the only way we are going to go home. Through the Berlin Conference and through the policies they put in place when we got our independence in the late 50s and early 60s, where they intentionally kept the economic liberation from us, gave us limited political liberation. And I'm saying limited because they still continue to control the politics of the land through their various conniving means. We are not in control of our destiny. It's like you and I, my daughter, like I said, we are trying to go home. We are lost in the forest. We are going west when we should be going east. First and foremost, Africa must be on the right path. You can win all the fights you want to win. If you are on a losing path, you are still going down. You can win all the fights you want. You're going riding in a derailing train. You're still going to go down. What Africa needs, I am not saying we do not have problems with corruption. Don't get me wrong. Corruption is a serious problem, and we must address it vigorously. However, when I look at the issues of leadership, if I were to simplify the conversation and say, let's talk about our issues as from scale of 1 to 10, I would put leadership around 5, 6. Why? Until France can leave the $500 billion on the continent, until all the other colonizers can stop extracting all these minerals out of Africa to the tune of billions, until illicit funds are stopped from getting out of Africa, until the looting of the illegal mining, the trade in plants and wildlife, all these illegal activities that are taking out of Africa trillions of dollars combined, they want us to not talk about it. And another big one are those safe havens from all the multinationals who are working in Africa. They have existed, majority of them, even prior to independence. They do not pay taxes. The average African on the street is paying taxes. These multinational corporations are not paying taxes using these safe havens. Again, billions of dollars are getting out of Africa. Allow me to put things in perspective. When you put all this corruption from outside together, you are talking trillions of dollars getting out of Africa that we are being told not to talk about. They have done a great job at making sure that the Africans don't understand the intricacies of what they are doing, the games that they are playing. All they want us to force us to believe is that corruption is your only problem, that leadership is your only problem. No, on a scale of 1 to 10, yes, leadership is an issue. In some cases, not all. Let me make that clear. Let's not paint Africa with one blanket, one brush. No, there are many African heads of states who are doing very well for their people. We cannot just blame it all on corruption. All of Africa is corrupt. That is wrong, and we must refuse it and deny it and call it out. If you want to talk about a corrupt situation in a particular country, then talk about that particular situation. But don't take that one particular situation and extrapolate it throughout the continent. That is wrong, and we will not accept it.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Arikana Chihombori-Kwau, for your time. I truly appreciate it. Women like yourself are an inspiration to young people across the continent like me who look up to you, your boldness, your eloquence, and your passion for the African continent. Thank you so much for your time. That's it for today's program. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at the Osasa Show, at POS TV Network, at the Osasa Show Foundation, and at...
We cannot expect history to make exceptions in our case. Everybody who came from a lower to a high position in the world at any time had to subject themselves to a form of collective discipline and unity. and they could not be scattered all over the place and achieve that container that is essential to all people, nationhood. And when you achieve nationhood, you must make an inventory of everything that goes into the making of a nation and have someone qualified to do all those things. One of the holdbacks is that we look for the glamour, too much glamour. Oppression depresses the ego, the sense of self-satisfaction. Now we have to go back, all the way back to self-satisfaction. And from self-satisfaction, there has to be group satisfaction. So while it is absolutely essential that you love yourself, because any love you have for other people is of no great value if you do not love yourself. And I'm not talking about ego washing just for the sake of ego washing. Every human being was put on this earth for a purpose and given a purpose by the Creator. And the first thing we need to ask ourselves, have we fulfilled our purpose? What is our mission? And every people on this earth must have a mission. And the main mission, as Malcolm X and others have told you repeatedly, and Garvey has told you, regain the land. Without land, there is no nation. Now, I am a little less enthusiastic about Nelson Mandela, because he has not asked for the return of the land. When he came to power, the whites controlled 87% of all the land in his country. They still control 87% of the land. Until he called for the return of the land, I will share with you and trade with you as much land in Africa as you will trade with me in Europe. If I have no European land, then you have no African land. And when Africa is fully cultivated, when what in its land, the great agriculture, mineral wealth, gold, manganese, cobalt, when these things are cultivated, there should be no poor African and no hungry African. Now these things are being cultivated for other people. What I'm speaking to is the very concept of nation seems to have eluded us. It will elude us so long as we ask foreigners to come to our country and do what we need to do. So therefore, when we take over a nation, we must have made an inventory of what goes of a nation. So many people have to be making shoes, So many people have been making safe to pen, holding a child diaper together. So many have to be designing the railroad and the railroad car. All the Japanese did is to take one automobile and break it down and begin to innovate, making different parts of it. And they put together what they had, an automobile. So there's no mystery about things we're from, and we are doing for other people the same kind of thing normal would be doing for ourselves. Now, if we wanted to start a great garment industry, inasmuch as most black women have worked in the garment district one way or the other, one time on buttons, on clothes, on all kinds of clothes. They worked in the district for other people. Why can't they work for us? Why can't they work on our tutelage and we find the salary to pay them? We all wear clothes. Now, there's no argument about the fact that we need clothes. And when we take for a nation, you need people who know metals. You need people who educate. You take that inventory, make sure you have those people either in training or functioning, and let each one train one. What we need to look at is the model for a nation. You have to have people who can do everything necessary to maintain a nation. We have to stop sickness, clean up, because our oppressor does not think it's more the other. If we came together as much as we are strategically located people in the world, meaning there are more of us in different places in the world than other people. I did not say that we are numerically larger than other people. Oh, something's happened. But we are strategically located. For if we brought all of this together in a great Pan-African Union based on the land, based on the possibilities of our agriculture and our mineral wealth properly marketed by us, but properly mined by us and refined by us, on our own terms, we can be a self-sustaining people. And we don't have to take over other people in order to do it. We are the only people fortunate enough, endowed with land and talent. If we took it all back and used it for ourselves, we would have more than enough for ourselves and enough to sell to other people. Right. And if we are willing to deal with other people on that kind of basis, there's no use of us sacrificing our young people in stupid wars that don't have to be fought in the first place. All right. But we can come together an honorable trade. Let's take one entity. Let's take the Caribbean islands. If it came together an honorable trade, they can be self-sustaining in food. In the area that used to grow food, you got supermarkets, condos, and golf courses. None of these things are doing the Caribbean people enough good to be worth sustaining. In Bermuda, They had a red onion. They had a monopoly on the onion. A Texan came, put some in his suitcase, and started an onion industry in Texas. Now the same Texan, the same, sell Bermuda onions, red onions, to the people of Bermuda. Now they got to go to a Texan now to buy their own red onion. And the land they used to grow their red onion is now either a golf course, a condo, or a big supermarket area. When people take away from you the right to, not only the right, but the ability and the right to sustain yourself, they take away from you what is vital to the concept of nationhood. Vital to the concept of nationhood, you have to feed yourself. You have to educate yourself. And you have to defend yourself. But if you've got gold and iron ore to the extent of the need of the West, and they cannot get it from you by war, then they'll make some honorable terms to get it. And those honorable terms between, they've got something you need, you've got something they need. And this exchange creates a zone of peace. Because you cannot fight each other and keep that zone all at the same time. We have to understand the structure of nations when the Asians first, then the Europeans, came into Africa. Now in my African course 1, I teach the beginnings. Now I will probably go further because now there's information on the Sudan and its connection with Egypt that didn't exist. What made Egypt a state? Bringing together a much-needed labor supply, developing the goods, the services, that they would be able to feed all these people. And because they could sustain them, food and housing, and could bring them together for religious fervor, all of this coming together, the lower and the upper Nile, made a state. They had to organize in some kind of protective fashion to become a state and to relate to the states in the South that was the basis of their origin. They came together, upper and lower Nile, and formed a country that the Greeks would call Egypt. And in their writings, in their folklore, in their myths, they created so much of the literature that would go into the literature of the world's three major religions, and that would go into the making of what the European calls civilization. What you forget in looking at Europe, and this is why people get away with so much, we don't look at the chronology of Europe. And when you look at the chronology of Europe, they began to emerge around 850 BC. What was happening in Africa? 850 BC. Egypt has spread itself so thin it was now threatening. On the eve of the 25th dynasty. Now, look at the dynasties of Egypt after the 25th there was nothing left worth being called a dynasty. That was the last walk in the sun when the brothers from the south moved up north and showed Egypt how to control a nation one more time. That last walk in the sun ended thousands of years of civilized living. And why could Egypt sustain such a large population over such a large area? It had a suitable food supply. It had a suitable housing supply. It had a spiritual life that did not offend the people or put one against the other. It already had every element that would go into the making of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Different people with different approaches to the religion made different things out of it. And some made God ungodly. That is true of Eastern religions also, because in the Hindu faith, they speak of the sacred cow, but not the sacred human being. So they are off too. Then people got into a habit of making comparative studies of their respective chosen gods, which was the worst thing they could have done, given the circumstances. If you look up the word God in a good etymological dictionary, God itself means different things, but none of the information about any of the gods gives them the right and the privilege of cursing anybody, because gods do not curse. And people must get this through their skull. Gods do not curse. Gods do not favor. The very word God eliminates that. Now, with the coming of foreigners to Africa from Western Asia, people not too certain about who they are in the history of the world, then or now, they began, because they could not have an African way of life. They were not equal to that kind of communalism. They became grabbers, created the embryo of what would later be capitalism. Now, you think capitalism will resolve if you got enough money. But if you got the money you wanted, you would have to cheat somebody, because that in itself creates an imbalance. So there is nothing wrong with capitalism properly used. It has to be used for the people and not against the people. And I do not believe it is impossible for capitalism to be democratic and to be honest and still survive. Yes, you have people who want super profits, and they began to destroy the sovereignty of other people and other nations. And when they take away your sovereignty, your responsibility, your very being, the essence of your political life, then they take away so much that goes with your spiritual and physical life. We have not talked enough about culture and the role of culture in sustaining a people. You have to first recognize you have culture separate and distinct from that of your oppressor, and that so much of that culture comes out of your trying to live in an atmosphere not exactly created in your favor. You are adjusting to somebody else's culture and somebody else's habits. A people, by virtue of living, creates a cultural style. They create even a killing style. This is why I didn't believe the thing about O.J. Not that black men don't kill, they do. They don't kill that way. See, physical mutilization in that way is part of the killing style of another people, mostly Mediterranean white. Sometimes we are passion killers. If an African man says, I'm going to kill you, if you avoid him 24 hours, you can end the whole thing. He changed his mind. So if you're going to kill you, he had to kill you right away. I'll leave you alone. See, when people study styles, approaches of other people, so many blacks have gone to the grave for things they did not commit, could have been saved, because that approach is not our approach. We don't stay around and play over the dead body. You're dead, you're dead. We're gone. And so when people study that, a whole lot of things, sometimes we're charged with. That's not exactly the way we do it. We're passion killers. Gonna kill you right away. Gonna let you go right away. And we just don't hold grudges as long as some other people. I lose sense of the possibilities. I'm still talking about nationhood. What do you have to do to sustain a nation? What are the responsibilities? People must be fed. Things must be distributed as close to equal as possible. People must be educated. And so when you gain control of a nation, all these things must be in your hands. And if they are in the hands of your former colonial master, you are not sovereign. You are not free. Now, Jamaica, if it had it together, had its political house in order, its culture house in order, it could sustain all the islands in the Caribbean Sea. There's nothing wrong with Jamaica being the sustaining island. It's the largest. It has the largest number of technically trained people for the kind of age in which we live. So we have to start reconsidering things and develop frameworks that will leave different people sovereign but dependent, as others will be dependent on them. and an exchange of what one has got. Now, Jamaica can make enough potatoes for all the islands, if it would. And yet some of the islands are sent to the United States paying three times more for potatoes. We have to come together as a people, supporting ourselves, educating ourselves, and estimate how many shoes we need, and if we could just sell half of the shoes, we can estimate the profit. And it could be tremendous. What I'm trying to say is that we shouted nation time too soon. We shouted nation time before we understood what goes into the making of a nation, before we made an inventory of the needs of a nation to make sure we have on hand the technicians, the supply lines, the educational system that could sustain a whole nation. Until you get that in focus, you are sovereign. You're not sovereign. No matter how many limousines your president rides in or how high the flag, it's nothing going to make your nation except self-reliance. And when we look at Du Bois, Booker Washington, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, all these men were saying basically the same thing using different words. And it was not a problem. It was not a problem of one or the other. We needed all of them in the time slot that the Creator put them on the earth. For each message carries on from the other message. One is reinforcing the message of the other. Now, if we knew this, the Congo situation would be such a situation. We knew when it came to power superficially, we knew that was one of the richest spots in Africa. So what are we going to do with our people who can take that rich spot and transfer it into a great and powerful sovereign nation without taking the rights of any of the people in the nation? I am excited about what's happening in Zaire, now renamed the Congo. But I think too many people, after Lumumba, after Mobutu, have about the same ambitions as Mobutu. And I hope those people won't just create another dictatorial power. In this country, which is so rich, and maybe the richest single country in all Africa, in gold, manganese, and copper, but rich in agriculture, to the point they can rent the Germans a piece of land more than equivalent to the state of Delaware just for a rifle range. In the first place, I don't know why anybody should let another nation have a rifle range of that size in its own country. That is part of the usurpation of the sovereign rights of the people of the Congo. Some parts of the Congo are so rich agriculturally, they have to put halters on the cows to keep them from eating themselves to death. In my last trip to that country, I got with a Congolese intellect. We went to a place called Kiev. Here the grass is so green and luscious, you have to stop the cows from eating, or they eat themselves to death. We got some of that same grass, went back to the hotel, cleaned it, and ate it as a salad. It was a decent salad. We were eating as good as the cows. What I'm trying to point out, if this country was that rich agriculturally, there is no excuse for anybody in that country should be hungry. And yet there are people there hungry. One of the biggest thieves in the Congo was one of Jack O'Nassar's personal friends. I won't call him a boyfriend, but he was a personal friend. He let Mobutu steal a lot so he can steal even more. And he's still walking around without a scratch. In what is now Zimbabwe, that used to be southern Rhodesia, Ian Smith controlled his personal land in that country. Is larger than the state of Delaware. Here's a man that killed thousands of Africans. And when the rebels left the field and let the politicians make peace, he's now a part of the parliament. His office is close to that of the president of the country. He should have been killed the first day. Now the African is not only hospitable to strangers and invaders, he's merciful and sometimes more merciful to them than to his own. Many of the Africans are not willing to forgive the atrocity that had demeaned their continent for well over 200 years. They're not willing to forgive. When did white people forgive? Did they forgive the Nazis? Hold on. They went to Nuremberg and put them on trial. And the key ones got hung if they didn't commit suicide ahead of time. I think we need to look at the word forgiveness, look at the word state, and understand what we mean by it. We're letting people go who murdered our children and to walk away scot-free with a confession. How much are we supposed to forgive? There are some things I do not forgive. There are some things I cannot forgive. And when I saw my mother for the last time in a Jim Crow wooden stinking hospital in the South, and she asked for a glass of water, and the white nurse wouldn't let me give her a glass of water. And I don't know whether a glass of water would have prolonged her life another hour or another day, but she was entitled to some water. When I tried to pour it for her, the white nurse let me know that I was not an employee there, and she's the one who decided who gets water. And I not only hated hospitals, I hated sometimes the personnel in the in hospitals. I get a feeling in my stomach every time I go near one. I did not forgive, and I never will forgive. There are some things I think it's best to try to forgive and forget. But what they're asking of us is what has never been asked of another people. When Europeans catch a European bandit on their land and kill him and drive him away, we have caught some bandits in our land. And sometimes, in fact most of the time, especially in South Africa, we should do the same thing. When Nelson Mandela came to power, whites controlled 87% of the land. They still control 87% of the land. Now, the agreement that he's contemplating making with Buthelezi, the most important thing, it would give different people in South Africa back their traditional land. If he can get away with this kind of treaty, but with sentiment serving such an important part in Africa, I think Africa will sentimentalize it to the point where they're going to say, let them keep the land on these terms. And if you get it, if they can get it in one term, then they'll take it on another term. It's just if you catch somebody on your land, they have to leave or stay only on your terms. And what we're asked of, what's being asked of us and the commission in South Africa, partly headed by Bishop Tutu, is to forgive and forget. And people now can come before us and confess, finish machine guns at Africans at Soweto, that other atrocity. Women, children, dead, gone. And I must forgive. It's a little too much. I am at heart a Pan-Africanist, and I want to conclude my remarks on the score of Pan-Africanism. We need not separate ourselves based on who's from a speck of dust in the Caribbean Sea, who's from Africa, who's from Georgia. Late at night, when you're trying to get a cab at Kennedy, nobody cares where you are from. If your face is black, you're going to have a difficult time getting that cab. And I've been in this situation. I thought of Johnny Johnson, a black multimillionaire. His chances would be no better than mine, maybe less. He's taller, equally black, and the cab driver might be a little afraid of him. The cab driver might take a chance with me. So I hang there. I'm passed up about 7 or 8 cabs and pass me by. Then a brother comes along. He knows that from Kennedy into town is about $25, really. Brother, I'll take you. $50. So the brother comes and takes advantage of the situation, cheats you, takes you home. So he's become a crook among crooks. But difficult. He knows when he looks at you, ain't too much you can do to him, you know. size things up, you know. So he'll take you. And you don't always get a brother to come by and take you. You wait and let some independent car hustling up a little money will take you into town. Now what am I talking about? I'm talking about nation. If you are part of a total nation, if you are a citizen of a total nation, then this don't supposed to happen to you, because your citizenship is supposed to be on the level with other citizenships. And why is it now, right now, you can go into an African bank, and if you're not first in line, whites will be waited on in preference to you? Because the mind has been controlled, oriented in such an extent it still follows colonial instructions 30 years after the physical presence has been gone. What we have to think, we have to think in the framework of nation. What is a nation? What goes into the making of a nation? And we must have on hand every item, spiritually, culturally, and politically. We have to lose our sentiment about so many of others who are not of us, who are not delivering, but who are prancing, playing games with time and situation. Things begin to move more and more towards some form of correlation. People sometimes misunderstand the nature of commitment. In the case now of Abedi Shabazz, I said, I will pray, I will do this. A good physician trained in how to handle a burning case can do more for her than 1,000 people on their knees. I'm not against people being on their knees, but I'm saying that while you're on your knees, somebody else will have to be doing something else more concrete, where the proof, the results, is more apparent. It's not one or the other, but each in its own place doing the job it needs to do. And too many times people train for jobs, don't get the jobs they are trained for among us, and we send away to get someone else to do that same job. We have to work well with each other. And I call Tommy to a Tom. Sometimes you have to Tom a little bit to a Tom in order to get things done. I don't think we know each other quite as well as we should. And many of us think, because of separate geography and colonial masters differ, there is a great deal of difference between the different approaches to different ones of us based on background. Our enemy don't think no more of someone from an island, or someone from Georgia, or someone from Carolina. He don't think no more. And so we have to stop all this nonsense, dividing ourselves based on sororities, fraternities, and social organizations, or what little speck of dust in the Caribbean Sea that gave us birth, inasmuch as we had no control over any of it. and when a people are out of power so long, they long desperately for power. And when they get close to it, they panic. And they spend so much time just giving it back to the person who had it in the first place. We have to, if we are going to follow prescription which I've laid down, Pan-Africanism or perish. If we cannot develop a concept of an African world union and participate one to the other, we might as well go out of business as a people, because nobody is going to respect anyone who are not the masters of themselves, feeding themselves, educating themselves, and protecting themselves. There is no European solution for your problem. Even if you join them in capitalism, you are a servant of capitalism. You don't have to join them in socialism. Well, you had that before they had shoes. You had that all along. All you have to do is to develop a socialist system that will take into consideration our total culture, our religious commitments, our spirituality. And we have to understand, before the rise of Europe and the occupation of Africa by Europeans, all of the killing, there was no killing, genocidal killing of Africans against Africans. Prior to this period, the one war in Africa that caused the largest amount of casualties was the Zulu Wars, lasting from the late 1700s to the middle of the 20th century. But wars to keep the Europeans out of Africa. I'm saying that we have to accept some responsibility for stabilizing the Caribbean islands, the whole continent of Africa. Have to have some kind of method of dealing with the Arabs and Islam, because no one came to Africa to do African people any good, and that includes the Arabs. And there's a good library of information on the subject, but if people don't want to read it or consider it, that's not exactly my fault. But nobody came to Africa to do Africa any good. Among the other things I'm working on is the role of the missionaries in conquest. Showing you that the Hebrew missionary was mainly commercial and still is. Christianity is mainly commercial and still is. Did you hear how many priests in the Congo? Over 10,000 priests in the Congo. Why is it that you can get guns to kill each other, but you can't get farm equipment to feed each other? Why are you so easy to get guns? You don't manufacture no guns. Why can you get them so easy? And why are you so difficult in getting farm equipment and basic things to teach kids basic technology? What I'm saying in conclusion, that our children should be trained from birth for some form of leadership. Find out what he can best do and make sure that he has a chance to do that particular thing and make a contribution to the total of the people through that particular thing that he gets done best. I'm afraid we're going to have to come together among African people some we may not like, and some may not like us. But we're going to survive. All of us are going to have to come together and say, great, Pan-African Union. I think a union of committed Africans will save all Africa. And because we have no desire